I'm Izzy Judd, and welcome to my podcast, Let's Talk Fertility. This podcast is sponsored by Pregnacare. During my own fertility treatment and pregnancies, I was recommended to take specialist vitamins and minerals to support my nutritional needs. There are many benefits to taking these supplements, and they also made me feel like I was taking a proactive approach to prepare myself and my body as best I could. Pregnacare Conception and Wellman Conception vitamin and mineral supplements provide advanced nutritional support for men and women trying for a baby, including zinc, vitamin D, and the exact levels of folic acid recommended for women by the UK Department of Health. Pregnacare, expert nutritional care while trying for a baby. To find out more, visit www.pregnacare.com. Today, my guest is television presenter and writer Alex Jones. Many of you will know Alex as the brilliant co-host of the BBC's The One Show, and in 2011, a Strictly Come Dancing semi-finalist. Having taken part in the same year as Harry, this is when we first met.
Yes.
Alex has guest hosted on BBC Radio 2 and presented TV shows such as Let's Dance, Shop Well for Less, and most recently co-hosted the Invictus Games. Also author of best-selling book Winging It, in which she writes about her own experiences of motherhood. Alex fronted the BBC One documentary Fertility and Me, so I'm interested to talk to Alex more about what she learnt and also about her own fertility story. So hi.
Oh, hi. Izzy, how are you?
I'm good. It's so nice to see you.
It's lovely to see you. I love the Strictly reference. The most undeserving semi-finalist ever.
No,
to
that's
grace
not
your
true, Alex. Did you dance with James?
I did.
Yeah.
Oh, controversial.
Right. Yeah. Oh, but it was so lovely to meet then. It feels like a lifetime ago.
It does. It does. Well, it's about probably, what, 7 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, crazy.
Crazy.
Okay, so thanks so much for coming and chatting to me.
Pleasure.
So I guess growing up, did you think about having a family? What were your thoughts around that?
I always assumed growing up that I would replicate what we had growing up. So I always thought, and I was very specific, I always thought I'd have two daughters. Well, obviously I'm wrong on that count. But I envisaged that I would have a family by 25. You know, when I was much younger, I thought, yeah, well, by 25, I'll have two little girls and that'll be it. I'll be married and all the rest of it. And of course, you know, for a lot of us, life just doesn't play out like that. And I hit 30 and I thought, no sign of husband or boyfriend, let alone children. And things just took way longer than I thought. But actually, you know, now I'm glad they've worked out as they have. I haven't got little girls. I've got a little boy. But I think you always want to, not always, but I think a lot of us want to replicate what we've grown up with. So I always thought about having two siblings together. And I never, never thought that would be a problem. It just didn't cross my mind. And it didn't cross my mind until I was 37.
Really?
No.
So when the documentary came about to do Fertility and Me, what was it that got you involved in that? Was it a subject you were interested in, or how did it kind of
come
about?
Very interested, because Charlie, my husband, and I just got married, and suddenly in our group of friends everybody was talking about, you know, the fact that they'd been trying for a long time. Some were pregnant, some were going through IVF, one couple were adopting because they'd been through IVF and had been unsuccessful 10, maybe 11 times. So suddenly the conversation was very focused on fertility, and it happened really in the space of a year. But I think probably because I was listening more within that year. I'm really old fashioned, Izzy, and I thought, I want to get married before we have children. And Charlie and I met quite late on. I was 33 meeting Charlie, and then he's very laid back. In brackets, hopeless when it comes to organisation. So it took him a while to propose. And then so children were kind of pushed further and further away. I mean, we are lucky that we did meet, because so many of my friends who are now kind of approaching 40 and have turned 40 are still looking for somebody that they want to have children with. But I suppose I tuned in then to a conversation about fertility that I hadn't really thought about. I just assumed that Charlie and I would be bulletproof. And of course, that's really naive. And I realise that now. But I think it's what most people think until they're in the zone where they're thinking about it.
Do you think a lot of that as well is because growing up, we are basically taught how not to get pregnant? So it feels like getting pregnant is actually something that could happen very easily because we're just told how not to get pregnant.
Completely. I mean, I would literally spent my entire life trying not to get pregnant up until that point.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, in the space of a day, when the decision is made, it turns on its head completely. And suddenly that's the most important thing. And as you said, it's the exact opposite of where you felt you were. And then I started thinking, oh my goodness, well, maybe this isn't going to be straightforward. Why are all my friends having these problems? And I mean, they were ranging in age, so it's not age specific, as you know.
Yeah.
You know, some friends were kind of early 30s, some were late 20s, actually. And then there were other friends who were kind of early 40s. So there was a really big range. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, I've no idea where I am on the spectrum. And actually, because we were, you know, later than we thought we would be, we were in our late 30s, I thought, well, gosh, there's no information out there that gives you any indication of where to go for help, where to go for a test, the different options. You know, people had started sort of throwing about the word freezing your eggs and all of this. And I thought, I don't know anything about this. And actually, having spoken to my friends, lots of us felt like we didn't have the information at the tips of our fingertips.
I find that really fascinating, actually, because so often people are not having these conversations. So the fact that you were really around it is quite interesting.
I think we were a tight group of friends. And I think one couple were really, really struggling. Mm. And then their conversation kind of opened the door to everybody else to be a bit more open about where they were with it. Mm. And, you know, the men were talking about it because, you know, very often people generalise and say, you know, boys don't talk about this sort of thing. But they were actually, because the want for a child isn't any less necessarily for a man. I mean, you can't put labels on people. And it became a very open conversation. But I realised that outside the group, there wasn't much chat around it. Mm. There wasn't much information. And I was very unclear what our options would be had there have been a problem.
Yeah.
Now, there was a lot of confusion when I made the documentary because I think people thought, oh, well, she must be experiencing problems. And that wasn't the point of it. I said very clearly at the beginning, it was from a starting point of not knowing if there was a problem, if we could conceive. It was just looking at the area and the world of fertility to bring it to a wider audience, something that never been seen on BBC One before.
Yeah.
And actually was received well because I think there was an appetite for it.
Yeah. And also I think because if you are right in the depths of your fertility experience. I know for me personally, you know, when your months and months or years are sort of stacking up, your perspective on fertility is very different to somebody that's coming at it fresh, starting to think about a family.
I'm sure.
So I'm, you know, for me watching the documentary, it's giving you that complete fresh first approach. What, you know, what are the starting steps, where do we go from here? And, you know, I found that really insightful. And one of the things we were just chatting about before was the fact that there are actually some basic tests on the NHS that a lot of women don't know they can actually have.
Yeah, so as part of the documentary, the producer suggested that I did these two tests that would give me a real clear indication of where I was in terms of my fertility. You know, it was kind of an age versus fertility sort of experiment, if you like, but not really an experiment because it's a test that anybody can have. And I suppose naively, I agreed straight away. And when I spoke to my husband that night about it, he said, are you sure, Al? Because actually these results are really big for us because you assume that everything will be okay. But if it's not, you're then going to have to go through the process of dealing with that on camera, you know, that's going to blow your dreams of a family to bits temporarily while we find a solution of how to rebuild those dreams in a sense.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh gosh, yeah, that's a way more sensible approach because I was just kind of gung-ho, yeah, I'll do these tests. But then, you know, sitting back and thinking about it, I thought, well, how else do you show a wide audience that these tests are available? And if I was starting from a neutral point of view, I needed to go through the entire gamut process. Of emotions and the process that comes with it. Mm. So I did do it. And luckily, the results weren't fantastic, but they were okay, you know, and we went on to conceive Teddy fairly easily. But it was just a blood test, and anybody can have these at your local GP. They very often don't want to give it. And they very often, like many of my friends experienced, were very, I don't know, were very kind of condescending when people went in and said, look, we've been trying for a year, nothing's happening, you know, can you help us? And they were like, well, keep trying, give it another 6 months. Mm. There was a lot of that. Now, I'm not saying every doctor's like that, because in the process of making the fertility doc, I met some fantastic GPs that were very helpful and very on the ball. And my own GP, to be fair, is exactly that person. But there seemed to be a lot of GPs who didn't rate it as very important on their list of stuff. And so when people came in with fertility problems, whether or not it was because they weren't educated enough to deal with it, or because they thought it was low down the priority list, for one reason or another, they weren't very helpful. Mm. But there is this blood test that you can have, and the blood test measures your hormone levels and will give you a good idea of where you are. So I did that, and I did an internal ultrasound to determine whether there was any polycystic ovaries, any problems with fibroids, all that sort of stuff. A test that lasted for 2 minutes, but with the both combined, it gave a very clear picture. And as I said, the results weren't brilliant. They were what somebody would expect for somebody who was at the time 38. Mm. But having said that, it was encouraging to know it was possible. Mm. So I think instead of wasting loads of time, you know, anybody out there who's just in the situation I was, wondering where they are, should just go and have these tests done. And then instead of guessing, you know, you've got a clear picture.
Yeah. Did you feel when you were sort of embarking on the whole fertility experience, was your age the biggest drive of wanting to know the information? Did you feel that there was a pressure or a fear around your age?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And I think it's fueled mostly by papers and headlines and but I mean I still feel the same as I did, you know, in my 20s. And I think there's lots of women like me who take pretty good care of themselves, eat healthily, exercise. Well, I used to exercise. Not so much anymore. But, you know, exercise moderately. I mean, Charlie and I cut out drinking straight away. You know, we embarked on kind of smoothies. I put walnuts in his. He was allergic, but I thought, hey, it's worth it. They worked in the end. But I think, you know, I don't know, there was a lot of talk around, you know, oh, once you're over 35, that's it. Fertility falls off a cliff. It's game over. And those headlines started to really scare me. They weren't on my radar until this point. Mm. And then I thought, oh my goodness, is this a thing? And I think what the documentary showed is age, of course, is a factor, but it's not the be-all and end-all. We're all very differently wired inside. And fertility, as you know, is a very personal thing. Mm. And each person's body deals and copes and does what it needs to do in a very different way.
Yeah, and from speaking to so many people on the podcast and out of the podcast now about the subject of fertility, you know, it's a difficult one because the facts are there in terms of your age and fertility. But so much of it is focused around the woman, and actually men can play a part in being just as fit and healthy and looking after their lifestyle to be kind of, you know, fertile as well, but we don't seem to discuss that as much as we do. Was that something in the documentary you learned?
So we spoke to a guy called Dr. Alan Pacey, and he's amazing. He's a specialist in male fertility. And he revealed some things that I couldn't even believe. You know, he said, literally after 40, a man's fertility halves by 50%. Well, nobody'd ever said any such thing before now. I mean, you keep saying, you know, you keep seeing in the papers, I don't know, people like Ronnie Wood and Mick Jagger having babies in their 70s. And men have this, I guess, you know, thought process that they can go on having children until whenever. Look at Des O'Connor. But I think the truth of it is that doesn't happen in most cases. And men's fertility is as fragile as a woman's. And as you say, eating healthy, being physically healthy, watching how much they drink, not smoking, all of that is as important. You know, it's a 50-50 chemical reaction, isn't it? And it's important that both sides of that reaction and that chemical reaction is as committed to it. Yeah. And I think there is a lot more pressure on the woman. And, you know, as this doctor instantly pointed out, there is as much pressure on both sides. But that's just something that's not really discussed.
So was there anything that particularly surprised you whilst filming the documentary, or something that you perhaps felt naive about before?
I think I was pretty naive about the entire process. You know, until I went into a lab and saw how IVF actually works and watched them inject the sperm into the egg. It was mind-blowing. You know, it's the beginning of life, and I felt really lucky and privileged to have seen that. But I think the one image and the one piece of footage that will always stay with me is when we injected in the lab a sperm into an egg that just crumbled. And the woman's egg was, she was 36 years old. And I suppose across the board, age isn't the biggest thing, but it did really show me that it's definitely a factor that needs to be considered. Now, the point is, we all know that, but what do we do about it? If you've not met the right person before your 35th birthday or whatever, I mean, it's not game over, of course not. But I think Charlie and I, and maybe couples like us, probably should have got our act together a little bit sooner. You know, we knew we loved each other, we were committed to each other, and we both say now we should probably have cracked on a little bit sooner.
But what was going on? Was your career sort of flying at that point?
Or? I mean, I'd never put career over family. Family was always the main focus for me. Career is something that I absolutely enjoy, continue to enjoy, and would still like to continue, even though, you know, children are the main focus now. I've never seen it as career or family. I mean, Mum didn't. You know, she did both. She took a lot of time off when we were little, but she still managed to have a really good career.
Maybe that's another part of our generation coming to terms with this whole reality that women do actually want to go back to work.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because the previous generation was very different. We're hearing our parents' stories, which was just so different. You know, Mum was at home with all of us until, you know, we were at least three. You know.
Oh, yeah. Mum was at home until I was seven, I think. And then she went back to work and went back part time. But she was, you know, with the same company from 18 until she retired at 60. So there was room within that career to take a break. What I do is very different. You know, taking a break is not an option for that long. Mm. But I've never thought, is it career or children? Career wasn't something I was doing in the meantime whilst waiting for a husband either. It wasn't that. It was just, I think the two can run side by side. I mean, not helpful that career sort of peaks at the same age as when I decided that, oh my gosh, I need to have a child as well. Yeah. But that's the same for lots of people, isn't it? You know, it takes time to build up a career. And then I found myself moving to London. And then it was here that I met Charlie. And it was just how it happened. And for lots of people, it's how it happens. Yeah. And we just have to deal with that best we can.
So obviously Teddy came along.
Yes.
Quite quickly.
I think it was the walnuts in the smoothies, although there's no scientific backup of that. But yeah, Teddy, thankfully, and we, you know, eternally grateful that he did come along quite easily. And it was kind of a textbook pregnancy. And I think that's the thing as well, because people assume, or there are some articles that sort of scaremonger and say, oh, you know, pregnancy's so hard when it's a bit later. And I'm like, hang on a minute, we are not 80. You know, you're just in your late 30s. I mean, it was completely fine. In fact, really straightforward, and more straightforward than some of my friends who've been pregnant in their kind of late 20s. Yeah. So I don't think age has a bearing necessarily on that. And I think it's luck as well. It depends on the baby, isn't it? And you can carry so differently with different children. So Teddy came along quite easily, which was lovely. So we had Teddy for 10 months, 11 months, and I found out I was pregnant again. And we were, of course, delighted, shocked, slightly terrified, Izzy, because the gap would be very small.
Did you? Because for Harry and I, we always sort of said, well, we'll just... It was a shock because I had had so many problems conceiving, but obviously we knew that it was a possibility.
Yeah.
But it was a total shock, and Lola wasn't even a year old at the time, so I can it was that feeling of,
oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, how do we? And that's the thing, you know, we didn't sort of set out to try for another, but we just thought, well, we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really want to take any contraception after Teddy, because I thought, well, you know, we do ideally want two. We don't know how long it's going to take. It might not happen as easy as Teddy did. So let's just see what happens. And we found out, when Teddy was nearly 11 months, that there was another little one on the way, which was a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
So we went to New Zealand over Christmas, last Christmas. We actually did the test there. I thought I was just feeling really unwell. My periods really hadn't come back they hadn't regulated after breastfeed and all the rest of it. So I didn't really know where I was. I had no idea how pregnant I was, or I just, you know, Charlie and I were just delighted. So we came back from New Zealand, went to have another scan here, which I guessed it was around the 12 week. And unfortunately, the baby didn't have a heartbeat, which was, it was very hard, because by that point we were actually 14 weeks. So it was quite
devastating.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah. I think when you have had a pregnancy, you sort of assume your body knows what it's doing.
What to do.
And it was, then to be faced with, seeing, and you know what you thought you were going to see at the scan.
And I think it's nearly worse, because, as you say, there's an expectation there.
Yeah.
And of course, the image we saw on screen was sort of what we expected. But of course, you know, it was still, and did it was very hard.
Did you see that? Did you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they had no idea when we went in. We went in full of the joys of spring, excited about seeing, you know, the baby for the first time, as you do. I mean, the 12-week scan is really special, isn't it? And we went in kind of skipping, you know, thinking, oh, this is going to be fantastic. By then, we'd come round to the idea. We'd got used to it. You know, we saw ourselves as a family of four. And
were you having pregnancy symptoms?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. Very different to Teddy. But I just thought, well, could be a girl, or, you know, you just think, well, it's part, you know, par for the course. You just think, well, I'm just a bit more sick. I mean, I was really sick and feeling incredibly unwell.
Mm.
But that didn't strike me as being odd. I just thought, well, some people are really tired, as you are in your first trimester anyway. But I just convinced myself, it's a little girl, and I'm having a different pregnancy. So we went in very optimistic, very excited, and it was awful. I mean, I can take myself back to that moment easily. Mm. And the both of us just broke down, because suddenly, because even at 14 weeks, it feels like you've been pregnant for a long time.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you've completely got used to the idea. And as you say, because we'd had no problems previously, it was such a shock. I just thought, well, how can my body fail me like this? I mean, what's happened? You know, have I done something? And then there's all of that, as I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Yeah.
Have I eaten something? Have I done something? Was I too stressed? You know, because I was really stressed in the beginning bit of the pregnancy before I realised I was finishing off the book, working full time with a very small baby. And I thought, oh my God, have I done this?
I remember turning to Harry, because ours was around Christmas time, and saying, because every Christmas there's one person that takes all the Christmas presents to each family member. And I was doing it that year, and I said, Harry, it's because I lifted all those presents I shouldn't have been lifting. You imagine these silly conversations in your head, but you think, what did I do?
Yeah. And the woman was brilliant. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a blur what she said afterwards, but she was very reassuring, and she said, look, there's nothing you could have done. I mean, it just doesn't work like that. Mm. It's just, you know, there's something wrong. There's something in terms of the chromosomes that are wrong, and it's your body really stopping it before it goes any further. Mm. And of course, I can reason that as a grown-up. I'm like, yeah, okay, so, you know, it's probably for the best. You know, you try and go through all of that, it's for the best. But you can't, deep down, you don't really feel that at all. I mean, I was absolutely heartbroken. And because nobody knew, I had to go back and do the show within an hour of this happening, because, of course, it was early days. We thought it was earlier than it was. So I had to go back to work and kind of, yeah.
It's that in silence, isn't it? Women suffering with these.
Awful. Awful. And Charlie was equally as upset,
of course,
you know.
Yeah.
And then we had to tell our mothers, who were the only ones who knew, who were absolutely devastated. And it was funny, really. It was a funny experience because, of course, I'd done the documentary and a lot of people were confused about that because they were like, but you didn't have any problems. And then I thought, it's funny how life works, isn't it? And then we had this huge problem. And I mean, I know miscarriage and, you know, you can read the stats as much as you like. So common, you know, 1 in 4 or whatever it is, 1 in 4 don't make it past a certain amount of weeks. But it doesn't help at the time.
And also it just shows you, you know, you never know what somebody's story is. And it's not for anybody to say one thing or the other, because you've no idea really what people are going through.
And then, you know, lots of people, as I'm sure you experienced, without knowing any of the backstory, because we very much kept that to ourselves. Well, you're the first person I've said to publicly. But I mean, nobody knew about it, and people yet would keep asking, so are you thinking about a brother or sister for Ted? And I was like, oh, if only you knew. You know, we have just had ourselves in a position where we were thinking about us as a family of four, and suddenly we're not, you know, it's so raw.
Yeah. When you have gone through difficulties, you feel, oh, I'm so lucky to have what I have. But I always wanted to give Lola a sibling, even though I know how fortunate I am, you know, and I think it's okay to feel that that's what you want, you know.
I think it's the same for us. I just didn't want Ted to be on his own. And I know there's lots of people who have one child and because they choose it to be that way, and who are extremely happy. But I think maybe it's because of my sister and I growing up together, and that's what I'd seen and that's what I'd imagined. And because we are, Charlie and I mean, you know, we parenting in our late 30s, early 40s to very small children. And you know, it's that fear of something happening to us and him being on his own. And, you know, so to everybody on the outside, I'd say, yeah, we're so lucky to have Ted. And of course, I mean that. But deep down, there was still a longing for a brother or sister, which wouldn't go away. It doesn't matter how much I reasoned with myself. We are so lucky to be where we are. And of course, we know that. But it just wasn't quite fulfilling the dream that I'd had for our family.
Yeah.
I guess.
So what happened following the miscarriage? Were you...
It was very complicated because the miscarriage, I think they call it a missed miscarriage. So, of course, there was no signs at all, nothing. The baby was still there. The problem with this was that months now and months were just passing.
And in your mind, you wanted to be pregnant with it. Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, you know, is this going to happen now or not? And then they just sort of kept saying, you know, you just need to wait to have a period and see whether your body just flushes everything out and it starts regulating again. And I was really impatient. I kept going back and saying nothing's happening. And after 3 months, I still hadn't had a period. And they said, well, it's probably because you've had two pregnancies close together and breastfed. You know, let's have another look and see. So then there was these further tests where they just sort of flush a dye through you and see. I mean, you're probably familiar with all of this. A lot of that going on. And I just thought, gosh, this isn't going to happen. You know, I must settle on having Ted and being happy with it. And I did sort of start coming round to the idea. I thought, well, we've tried our best. You know, we'll
and
give
you don't
them-
want to spend, you know, those early kind of precious months with the baby, thinking, losing that because you're thinking about the next. I mean, I remember always being fearful of that with Lola, thinking, was I going to have to go through another round of IVF while she was still so little? And I wasn't sure if I could actually cope with that.
Exactly. You do worry about not being in the moment with an already very young baby and enjoying their development and really taking it in whilst being quite consumed, really, with the idea of having another one.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spoke to lots of friends and they said, Al, are you sure? You know, you're really happy and Ted's a lovely little boy. And I knew all that, but part of me was like, oh, but if only just we could have a little sibling for him. Over the summer, I started having periods again. So I thought, great. So started on the vitamins and started on the smoothies again, on the walnuts, and Charlie's tongue was swelling up. But actually, we knew that that worked last time, so we were going with it. And I started thinking, oh gosh, maybe there's a little chance now. And then in September, I missed a period, although I didn't really know whether I had, because obviously they were a bit all over the place. But on the off chance, I did a pregnancy test and it was positive.
Oh, it's such happy news.
Oh, it's so lovely. So we are delighted and we kept it really quiet for a really long time. Because the only thing is, as many people listening to this podcast will know, it's very hard to enjoy, especially those early months after something so horrendous has happened. Mm. You know, every day you're so conscious of, do I feel pregnant? Do I not feel pregnant? Have the symptoms gone? I was Googling all the time.
And the fear of going to the loo.
The fear.
Oh.
Awful.
It is just awful.
And it was a bit weird with me because the last one had been a missed one. I thought even that won't potentially tell me, you know. And of course, at the, you know, in the early stages, you can't feel anything. You don't know. And I was looking for signs. Do I feel a bit sick? Do I feel a bit sick? Am I tired? I'm quite tired. That's probably quite good, isn't it? You know, and Charlie just said, Al, there's nothing we can do. Mm. We just have to wait until we have a scan. And the hospital were fantastic. They did give me a scan at 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Just to see, and there I saw a little moving, little dot, basically tiny. But that was such a lovely moment just to see, because I'd convinced myself, no, it won't be, it won't work. And then we had a scan again at 10 weeks, and then, of course, at 12 weeks, by which point I relaxed a little bit more. But I'm still not fully relaxed.
No.
Because I don't think you ever will be. You'll never enjoy it like you did when you didn't know any of this.
Yeah. Because, you know, that's the thing, you know, miscarriage takes away that from pregnancy. And, you know, I think until both Lola and Kit were born, I don't think I truly relaxed. I think that's why Harry was so emotional when Lola was born, because I think it was the release of everything.
Just know, relief just of knowing, oh my gosh, the baby's with us, tangible.
Yeah.
We can hold the baby. And, you know, my boss, who I told about the pregnancy quite early on, because obviously, you know, he's my boss and he needed to know. And he said, oh, well, you know, when should we tell everybody? And I said, honestly, I can't bear it. I need to have as many tests as possible and leave it to as late as possible, because I just can't live through that in public. Mm. I just can't do it. I didn't even tell my friends. Nothing. We just kept it between ourselves. And it's only recently that I feel confident enough to say, well, I have to, because it's becoming very obvious, is it? Which is a lovely feeling. You know, it is lovely. But I'm still a bag of nerves.
Yeah.
You know, it'll never be the same experience as the first time.
No, I feel like I never had that first time, you know, because I went into it so fearful. And it's so common. And yet we're here talking about it. But it's very difficult to really speak about it and really how it feels. And yet it's so terrifying when you're going round with that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, and you're holding it and you're holding it. And, you know, it's this sort of desperate want every day for everything to be okay.
I mean, I'd say that 80% of people I know, of women who were expecting, have gone through the same fear. Mm. And when you think of it like that, it is amazing that it's something that's so that's kept quiet so much. That's not discussed very widely. Because it's something so deeply personal that you can't sometimes even articulate how it feels because you feel such devastation. Mm. It's very hard to come to terms with.
I mean, to think that you went back to work and were live on TV with that and no one knows.
No. But it's what, you know, it's what we do as women, isn't it?
I know.
We do. You know, it's that horrible thing where, you know, we want to keep it quiet. We have to keep it quiet because obviously you don't know up until the 12-week mark. And your body's going through all these emotions. And that's in a good, normal pregnancy. You know, you're going through these gamut of emotions and you're feeling really ill and you just can't tell anybody. And it's quite difficult anyway. But yeah, to live through something so deeply personal, but so personal, I couldn't bear to share it. So there was no choice but to carry on with real life.
How brave, Alex.
Well, as most women have, though. I mean, I know at least two of my friends have told me since, yeah, it happened to me. And then they were there at work doing the job they do, because that's just what we do, isn't it?
You mentioned just a little bit about Charlie being upset from the miscarriage. Was he open with you about his emotions?
Very. He surprised me, actually, because he broke down in tears instantly when she delivered the news that nobody wants to hear. And Charlie takes longer than me to process things generally, to get his head around things. But by this point, he was really excited. I mean, he was more terrified at the beginning. He thought, hang on a minute, we've got an 11-month-old. What's the gap? And then we started counting and But by this point, we were really excited. And we did spend days, weeks talking about it very openly afterwards. I think he did say on many occasions, I will never feel like you about it, because it's your body that's going through it, especially in that no man's land, you know, where we knew the baby or the fetus, I should say, at that point, because I think that's easier to deal with, didn't have a heartbeat. But the fact that it was still inside me, that...
For that week.
Oh, that was the most horrendous week.
Yeah. Because I don't know if you felt it, because I'm so used to Harry being this sort of rock and really strong and, you know, kind of, if anything's ever wrong, he's like my absolute pillar.
Yeah.
But when you go through something like that, you're suddenly both vulnerable.
Oh, it crushed.
And that's hard, isn't it? When you feel like the person closest to you, you need them and they need you. And we almost took it in turns.
To be upset.
Yeah,
I know. Because, and I mean, I can be quite strong, surprisingly sometimes. But then at other times, I completely fall apart. So I think we probably subconsciously did the same. And when he was really falling apart, then I was there to comfort him. And then the situation would be reversed. Mm. But it's just that, you know, In the life of a woman who's pregnant, 14 weeks is a heck of a long time. Mm. You sort of feel nearly halfway there. Well, you are. Yeah. You're 6 weeks off halfway there.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just for me. You know, we'd both processed it and lived with the idea, had settled on the idea, and it was a huge blow. And I'm not saying it's any easier when it happens sooner. But obviously that's just our experience, and we found it tough. And I found it tough seeing him, you know, weaker than he normally is. He'd been really affected by it. And as you say, it's hard when that's the person you rely on normally. And suddenly we were both a mess.
Yeah. So moving forward.
Yes.
You're going to have two little bundles. How are you feeling about being away from work, being back at home? Because I found it difficult. I was just sort of getting a balance again of, you know, having Lola, but also doing a little bit of work. And then obviously Kit came along and I was sort of, it was quite a time just shifting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is scary. I spoke about it really honestly when I had Ted, about how nervous I was about going off on maternity leave. And that nervousness hasn't changed at all. I mean, I went back to my job, it was all fine. But that, you know, I still have the same feelings. I wouldn't change this for the world. And if it meant losing a job, then I would. But of course, you know, it's another maternity period, which feels quite soon after the first one. And, you know, it's the same in any industry, but I can only speak, I suppose, about the media. It can be very fickle. The BBC are incredibly supportive and were last time. And I know they won't want me to feel this at all. And it's all about what is coming from me. It's only coming from me. But I can't help it. You know, it's, yeah, it'll be odd. I mean, the thing is, though, I know that when I was off with Ted, I didn't even think about work because you just haven't got time.
No.
You know, yeah. You just can't let
you're
that
in a totally different zone.
Yeah.
Aren't you?
I mean, until you go back to work and you can leave the house and close the door and you're on your own again. You know, I literally didn't think about it from the day I went off on maternity until the first day I stepped back into the studio, really. But there was definitely a fear there building up to the last day before I went off. And that fear will be there again this time.
Do you have any ways of sort of managing it or any tips about balancing?
I think it's a bit better this time because I know I've done it once and it was fine. You know, nothing terrible happened. But in terms of balancing, I'm still working it out myself. I mean, I don't know.
The guilt is just relentless.
Horrendous. And I mean, and I see pictures of Teddy in the week, you know, when he's with this lovely girl who looks after him. And there's pictures of him, you know, in the park near us. Beautiful, lovely pictures. And it just eats away at me. I think, great.
And you know what?
Why aren't I in the park?
Exactly. And what shocked me personally from going through the struggles was that I remember saying, well, I mean, I will just always want to be mum. You know, I'm always going to, that's absolutely everything. And for me, it's been quite a tricky transition, realising that I need more for myself in order to be the best mum that I feel I can be. And that has been quite difficult for me to process, you know, because I think that's a whole other level of guilt because you know how many people are also experiencing these difficulties and, you know, you've wanted it for so long and then they're there. And then, you know, emotions don't end. You still are into a whole new realm of, you know.
Yeah, I think the problem is as well, is when you're not doing, unlike, I mean, the majority of mothers these days, we're not doing one job. So while stay-at-home mums have a really hard time, working mothers that have a hard time, it doesn't seem to be pleasing anybody. I mean, whatever you do is wrong in somebody's eyes, which is so tiresome, you know, because all we're all trying to do is our best at the end of the day. But I think what I find very difficult is switching my brain. So, you know, yes, I can juggle the logistics, but it's that switch from being a full-time mum in the morning to then suddenly having to be professional and being out the door and being somebody completely different when I've still got Weetabix crushed into my jumper or when I've never got as much makeup on anymore as I used to because my time with him is precious and I don't actually care what I leave the house looking like anymore. Which is wrong. And my mum's like, but Al, your job is on the telly. And I'm like, I know, mum, but I don't know what to do. I can't do, you know. But when I'm there, I'm fully focused. And I
don't
enjoy being
it's just,
there.
It's shutting the door.
Yes, and
then
getting
you
into the next bit.
But it's only once you're out of the situation and into the next situation that I feel I can switch off a little bit more.
Yeah.
So thanks so much for chatting.
Oh, God, pleasure. Oh, pleasure,
talk
pleasure.
All day, Alex. There's just a few questions that I ask just everybody.
Yes.
So the first one is just, did your parents teach you anything about the meaning of fertility?
Well, I mean, growing up, no. That's why I think I just assumed it wasn't going to be a problem, you know. But then mum has always been very much, she never put pressure. You know, when we got married, people were sort of very quick to say, well, you know, your mum probably wants grandchildren. And I said, she probably does, quietly. But she'd never say that out loud. Mum is a realist. And she, you know, she knew that my path was different to hers, different to my sister's. And she knew that it was something that I longed for, you know, to have a family. But she wasn't naive enough to think that it was a guarantee.
Yeah.
I think she was a bit more realistic than I was, actually. You know, and she said, well, look, Al, you know, you'll always have a family. You know, your sister's got children. But, you know, if it'll happen, it'll happen. Great.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things, you know, you have to accept that sometimes life takes you in a different direction. So she was very real about
it. Lovely mum.
She's, I mean, thrilled now, of course. Aww. You know, and then when I said, Mum, I'm pregnant, the first time she went, oh my gosh, Alan, my father, she went, the baby is having a baby. And I looked at them as if to say, what? And I was like, but my sisters. And she said, it's different, Al. You were the first one.
Oh.
And, you know, I think it's because it was relief. They didn't know whether it was going to happen. And
yeah.
It was a lovely moment.
Yeah. What do you think is the right question to ask somebody going through fertility struggles?
Oh, God. Well, there are so many questions I think that you shouldn't ask people. I think it's more of what not to ask as opposed to what to ask. It's very different, I think, whether you're talking to a friend, a very close friend who might be experiencing the same, then I think it's an open conversation that you can have. But what I found really hard was the questions directly afterwards. And people would ask naively with the best intentions, you know, are you thinking about siblings yet? And that can set you back so far. I think questions about fertility are best avoided
on
the whole.
You know, secondary infertility does exist. So it's not assuming that just because you have one child.
Yes, I think it's, yeah. Is not assuming and probably not asking too much of anybody until they're happy to tell you they're pregnant. And they will when they're ready because it is such joyful news.
Mm.
But in the meantime, always be mindful, I think, that there might be stuff going on.
Yeah. What's the kindest thing you can do for yourself when going through a difficult time with your fertility?
Gosh, I think the kindest thing you can do is protect your relationship. You know, that's, I think we, you know, we struggled just after, I think as well is because it was the double whammy of having a small child that was going through a particular phase of not sleeping, as we are now. You know, and you think you're going to be divorced by the morning. But then having that, the excitement of a new sibling taken away, and then the months afterwards of thinking, oh my God, this isn't going to happen. You know, why is this being so complicated? And I think the kindest thing that we did was really be mindful of it. And we looked after what we had together.
Yeah.
So, you know, Mum and Dad very kindly took Teddy for the weekend. And we had a few weekends, just us. And that kind of glued us back together.
Mm. And do you have a mantra that you follow or?
Yes, stick walnuts in your smoothies.
That's a good one. And just, you've talked there just about being mindful, and I do a little mindfulness exercise at the end of each podcast.
Oh, right.
That hopefully one might help you, but also other people listening.
Okay, yeah, good.
So this one, and also you're talking about potentially divorcing your husband by the morning, so this might be quite relevant to you.
Okay.
So it's really simple. It's called WAIT. And it basically stands for, why am I talking? And it's to think the word wait before you speak, because so often in a heated situation, whether that be with your husband, a partner at work, your child, it's remembering what we're all taught when we're little to just think before you speak and just to take a moment to think, wait in your head before you actually ask the question. And you think, is this what I want to say? Is this how I want to say it? Or shall I just park that and revisit it in a little bit when I've calmed down a bit? So that's just my little
I love
tip.
That because I could have done with that quite a lot of the last few months.
You'll be thinking, wait, in your head.
Because, you know, you can sometimes get into a heated situation with your partner, with me. Majoritively of the time at the moment. And I do think, why did I say that? I didn't even mean that.
I know.
Mean, on the landing at 4 a.m., that is not what I meant. And I don't feel like that now that it's daylight. And why did I say that? And I know that he feels the same. So I think that's really good
Alex,
advice.
I've been there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Honestly, I've really enjoyed having a chat.